Cornell Insight System.
Thank you. And guys, as we get started here today, I'm going to hit you with a remember when. And when I say remember when, I wasn't actually there with you, okay? I'm going to assume with this group in the audience and kind of polling the demographic here of the remember when you were at a football practice and you saw that drill again. And you thought to yourself, what is the point of that drill? Or maybe you're in a clinical setting and you have that kid come back who you've already treated, he's been through PT, and he's back with you again, and he was doing the same thing that he was doing the first time he came to see you. Today I'm going to talk about a sabermetric approach to protecting football athletes. A lot of you guys have heard the term sabermetric, you think baseball. Why is a guy from a football company talking about a baseball metric? Well, we've adapted it, right? Sabermetrics came from baseball looking at trends and stat lines and statistics, and what could we do with different trends to improve player performance, to improve our success as a team. And as was stated before, I am the category business manager for Smart Helmets at Riddell. But the intention of this talk here today is not to get you guys to get Riddell helmets. Okay, it's to develop further an understanding from a football coach's perspective, working with the sports medicine staff. How do we enhance that dynamic? Because I think everybody can hear, remember when? That one time your coach told you how to treat a student athlete's injury? He said, well, what is he doing with that band? Why has he got it up at that weird angle? I don't know what good that does, right? So the remember whens we're going to hear a couple times today. But my goal is to provide a further understanding not only to that dynamic, but what information is out there from a technology standpoint in approaches and adaptations of research and things that are out there to enhance that dynamic to better protect student athletes and understand the behaviors that are going on the field. So a couple weeks ago, I had a chance to sit down with Hall of Fame quarterback Peyton Manning. Now, I can't play the video because it's not out yet, and there's a lot of PR stuff that has to get combed through, but we really did a Gruden QB camp. But what we were doing was talking about smart helmets and how coaches can use data or stats in regards to head impact exposure and analytics to look at what's going on. Now everybody's heard about how he prepares, right? Very analytical. Day before games, combing through everything, and it still holds true. Every single thing we did and had bulleted out, it wasn't scripted, but he's dialed in the entire time. What I took away from this conversation, and as I work with all of our guys across the country, working with athletic trainers, sports medicine staff, and football coaches, is football is evolving. And along with the evolution of football, there's a new generation of coaches. And when I say new generation, I'm not just talking about young guys. I'm talking about coaches that have been coaching a long time that are evolving what they do on a daily basis, on a weekly basis, really looking at how they look at their team. Now, the way you guys might look at student athletes and football players is kind of flipped for football coaches if we think about it, right? Football coach probably looks from the team level to his units, OD, special teams, position groups, and then individual players. By the time you get someone, it's the individual player. What we're going to look at today is how from that individual player can we reverse engineer it back from what positions he's playing, what groups he's a part of, what were they doing, and then how's that affect the team as a whole. Anybody ever turn on TV Saturday or Sunday and still see this? And if you're off to the side, you're like, it's blurry, I can't see it. That's intentional. Right? That's on purpose. This is some old reel I found. I don't know. 97% of high school football programs across the country right now are using some type of web-based film platform. 10 years ago, there was probably a coach on Friday night after the game, drove halfway down the freeway, met at McDonald's, traded off VHS tapes, and then drove back home, all to get up back in the morning to pick up donuts, go meet the coaches to watch the film that he picked up at a rest stop the night before. Right? Now, this can get uploaded to the website. It's the behavior of the coaches that what they're doing is they're looking at what happened and looking at how do they get better weekly. And they're evolving the tools that they use to do that. My first example of the tools that are out there as far as head impact exposure and data collection, this was the first HITS system. And when I say HITS, that is the head impact telemetry system. It's one of the foundations of head impact research, cited in over 80 published accepted studies. This one's from 1971, so you can see here this guy's got a strap with a couple telemetry points, some type of battery pack that I wouldn't want to wear if it got wet, right? I wouldn't want to wear that, right? So that was 1971. And I'm going to show you an example, and we'll talk a little bit about what else is out there, of now how every impact can be analyzed inside of a football helmet. So there's different platforms to be able to do this, but really the sense is every impact that occurs inside a helmet is analyzed. And when we talk about head impact exposure, really the way to drill it down, if I'm explaining to a coach, is who's getting hit or hitting, where on their head, and by that I mean location or position on the head, and how hard. You know, you could drill down much deeper into, you know, linear, angular acceleration, rotational acceleration, but who, where, and how hard are they hitting? And really you take it to how much from there. So to understand the coaching process, and you might have some adaptations of this that you use in your training room or with the kids that come in to see you, but it really all starts with the preparation. We look at how do coaches prepare every day, every week, for an entire season. They're looking at how do we develop our kids off the field. They're watching film, they're installing schemes. The second one's going to be the observation. So let's say we installed an offensive scheme of practice here. Next one's going to be we're going to put it into play. Right? And these can be drilled down to the individual level for individual techniques. Right? Because I'm not just going to put a kid in and expect him to know how to tackle like an All-American linebacker when he's 11 years old and he's never played football before. And we'll discuss some of the adaptations and the escalations of technique-based coaching in a little bit. But after you observe it, you're going to evaluate film, data, stats, and then you're going to intervene. And this is going to be cyclical, right? It's a repeating process every week. Every day we're doing this. And there's different types of coaching. There's going to be drills during practice where we might not be coaching technique in a team drill. 11 guys versus 11 guys. It's tempo. We're trying to get as many reps in, as many plays in as possible on a Thursday before the game. Right, but every practice, and you'll see this in a little bit, there's a structure to it. It escalates up a little bit. There's technique, and then there's more game situations. So the two core fundamentals, if you ask pretty much any football coach, that's going to be involved in everything that gets down to it, as players develop in some way, are blocking and tackle. Everybody agree? Probably along those lines, blocking and tackling are at the foundation of how players are performing, right? But when we also talk about head impact exposure, who's hitting, where on their head they're hitting, and how hard, probably some of the foundations of that here, right? So we're looking at when are players blocking and tackling, how are we coaching that technique, and what data can we get from it? So I've got some examples here. All football coaches. There's something similar about all these pictures. Anybody want to guess what it is? What was that?
Paper?
Usually the answer is they're all yelling about something. I think this guy, you can't quite tell if he's yelling yet, right? But it is, it's the paper. Every single one of these guys has a piece of paper in his hand. It's a practice plan. Go out to a practice. And tucked in the back of coach's shorts right here, folded up, he's probably got some notes on it, probably spilled something on it. He's got his practice plan. Looks about like that. And there's this meeting here. They got the practice plans. Now, if you're an athletic trainer, were you in this meeting? No? No? Right? Because one of the important parts here is to understand what the role is. Right? Everyone in this room has a knowledge base, right? You all got your skills. That's why you're continuing to get educated. But I want to point out this study. It's from a comparison of high school sports injury surveillance data in reporting by certified athletic trainers and coaches. Although it was a relatively small study, I believe it was 28 sites, 28 schools with an athletic trainer and a football coach. We're not going to go too deep into the stats on this, but you know, one of the groups was almost always present and actually answered to the inquiries and the reporting. One of them wasn't there all the time. But when you had an injury occurrence for any of these, they looked at the answers about these different lines, and what was the correlation or the similarity between player was injured, doesn't matter what type of injury it was documented. What year were they in school? 94%, 95%, right? Their age, 81, weight, height, a little bit more varying, right? So the type of exposure, pretty easy one. Did it happen in a practice or in a game? And what I'm getting to here is you can see some of these have a pretty high score. The what, you know, what happened? Where were we at? You know, what was the weather? One of the higher ones. But if we go down to the type of practice, the lowest score on here, what type of practice was this? And you could perceive this in a lot of different ways. From the type of practice to the practice time, you know, was it related, if in a game, to illegal activity? Was there a targeting? You know, was there some type of illegal contact? Everybody remembers the weather, everybody's on the same page, but what type of practice was it was the lowest one? Because there are different types of football practice. Tuesday practice, higher contact, higher tempo. Wednesday practice, higher contact, higher tempo. Then you get closer to game day, you're gonna start to ramp that back down. Because really coaches, they're trying to find that balance. How hard can we go before it's too much, but we wanna get our guys primed up for game day? Right, so the point here of showing this is, are we on the same page? And is there an open dialogue? And is there a conversation about what are we doing in practice? And what's that leading to? Right, with that, you know, only about a quarter of the folks in that study knew what type of practice a player was in when they got hurt. And you could take that down even another level to what were we doing in practice when that happened? So what is the process and the plan to not only expand your knowledge base, but a coach's knowledge base? We're going to talk about how to approach that conversation here in a little bit. But what are the skill sets that are required to really have that understanding? And really driving down to identifying opportunities to modify or enhance activity to better manage that player's safety. All right. So again, who's ever been out of practice? Whether you were involved at the school, it was your kid, and you've wondered, what are they doing with that drill? That drill probably had an assigned level of contact of some sort. Now, it might not have been documented, but what we're seeing now is a lot of states are looking at how much contact are we allowing our programs to have during the week. Is it, you know, they can have 2 days of contact with no restrictions on minutes? Can they have 4 hours of contact throughout the week? And it's up to the coach to really schedule that and lay that out. I'm gonna reference here the recommendations and guidelines for minimizing head impact exposure and concussion risk in football. This one came out in 2014 from the National Federation of High Schools Concussion Summit. Really, if you break down a drill, we got five different levels. Escalating from air, which is non-contact player running unopposed, technique-based drills on bags, still not hitting another player, not a competitive drill. Control starts to get a little bit more competitive, still at assigned speed. But control, this could be a drill where there's, you see here an offensive player, defensive player assigned speed. Right at this moment, the whistle blows. You've probably seen these drills. It's not where they're not hitting out here. So that guy right here caught a bubble screen. This guy flew out to the flat from the inside box. Whistle blows, they stop. This guy probably keeps running 10 yards, you know, coach the drill, the rest of the defense swarms to that spot. But during that drill with those two perimeter players, you might have had a thud type drill, which thud is going past that whistle. There's no whistle right before contact. You're going to the point of contact. That's when the whistle is. So you go control right before, thud is at the whistle to live, which is a game situation. That's full contact. This is the only drill level where there would be players going to the ground, there would be full contact exposure. So as we plan our practices, we can look at what are the different levels of contact. And this is a tool we've built. Again, this isn't part of a helmet. This is something that's available to the public. Remember that piece of paper that every coach has tucked into his pants? Right? He probably has it on an Excel spreadsheet on his computer or a Google Doc, right? And he's texting back and forth, group text, see what's going on. What do you want to do in period two? We're going to do one-on-ones, right? What we've done is we've built a tool where you can assign those levels of contact and then project out for each position group, how much have we planned, right? Because if we want to objectively look at what's the exposure on the backside, how often right now in this conversation, this dynamic, do we really know what we planned? I could ask Coach on his opening script how many zone read plays he has on his first 12 plays. He knows that real well, right? How many times do we plan to run that bubble in this situation? They know that. But they're also talking about that, and you're talking about it with them. This is how many kids I got in my room. They're getting treated for this. I got two shoulders. I got a knee. I got a hip, right? But what are we doing? What's the activity that leads into that? That's something that up to this point hasn't really been dug into a lot. So we've built this tool to be able to provide a tool to objectively plan the exposures by position group, by period in practice, who's involved, which would be the unit and position group, and then the drill in here. So you can see for different days, it might change by position group. You can toggle this to unit and see offense and defense or the entire team. But this might be a day where you have more team on that drill where the perimeter guys are control, right? Whistle blows, guy keeps running 10 yards to finish through the play, defense swarms. Those guys are control, but in the box, the interior, those guys are exposed to more head impacts. So what might be a control for the guys on the outside, anybody ever seen a Division I offensive lineman play in practice? I've had the opportunity to go out to some practices. Those guys got one speed. It's fast and it's go, right? They're competing for a spot and a scholarship sometimes behind another guy who's 6'4", 260 pounds and runs about 4'5", against another 6'6", 320 pound offensive tackle, right? And just because they don't have shoulder pads on or lower pads doesn't mean they're not going to go hard. And there is data out there to show, and you could dive into it, to show that on days non-padded practices, sometimes there's more head impact exposure. Right? I could cite some of my playing experience. I was telling some of the guys earlier, days that we didn't wear shoulder pads to practice, I played offensive line. Right? The defensive tackle in front of me that I played against every day, he was, we'll call him tough, he was mean. Right? Didn't care who he was hitting. I knew no matter if we had shoulder pads on or not, he's going to take his crown of his helmet, he's going to put it in my collarbone. Right? Because he wants to beat me. Even though it's practice, he wasn't as bright as everybody else. He didn't quite get that part. But I still wore that skelly or the sub-shoulder padding because of that. So guys have that one speed, and when we look at the practices, we can start to look through these drills, different periods. When we bring in data from a smart helmet platform, we can start to look at the cumulative volume of head impact exposure. So this one's for an entire team, right? And we break these down. This is really the how hard factor. There's different metrics you can use to define this. We use one called HIT-SP, right? Now, obviously the higher magnitude are going to be in the orange and red here. But what I'll point out to you, and I kind of talked a little bit about this earlier, every practice has its own identity. Usually it escalates up like this, right? Now, if I look here, something's a little bit out of the ordinary. This is from the team level. At the top, we have what period or drill that was during above. So we're looking from the team level at this practice plan into here's my offense and then my running backs group. This is an individual running back. So reverse engineering it here, this is an outlier. Usually the individual drills earlier in practice are technique-based coaching. You're not going to expect or plan for as much head impact exposure because that's likely going to come in your thud or your live drills towards the end. You've ramped up. You're coaching the technique. You implement it. You observe it. You evaluate. And then you recycle. So during this one here, we've got a running back during our individual period has, you know, pretty much 75% of the team's impact exposure during that period. So what do we do with that? And what happens when we limit the amount of full contact practices? This is the conversation we're going to have to go with Coach, and he's going to ask us, so why would I do that? Right? Because again, coaches are trying to find that balance between what's enough, what gets us primed up, and where's that sweet spot. So here I reference a study from 2014 that looks at really what happens when we limit the football player's head impact exposure after limiting full contact practices. This one's from the NATA Journal of Athletic Training. So this study, again, there's several different ones out there. If you have questions, I can point you to them, but I'm going to reference this one. Was from the 2013 to 2014 season. What it was in a state where they didn't have any contact guidelines. There's no recommendation in the 2013 season. In the 2014 season, they implemented that teams were allowed to have two full contact practices during the week. So taking it from more than two down to two, there wasn't a specific minute time limit on this one, reduced the head impacts by 42%. Because again, what are we planning for and what actually happened? Now, if we're trying to actually reduce something, we're not talking about reducing technically the statistical significance of injury, but it does show that there is a difference. We reduced the overall occurrences by 42%. And what we found, again, talking about the interior players, the exterior skill type players, is that the linemen showed the most statistically significant decline from season to season. By saying, okay, here's how much you can hit a week, our offensive and defensive line went much farther down than the other position groups. Now, let's address some of the concerns. If I tell coach, you can't hit as much during the week, my first recommendation wouldn't just be open up that conversation in that way. Right? Don't go, hey coach, I don't like your drills, I think we should change them. What would you do if coach walked into your office and said, why are you doing that with him again? I don't really like that one. Back when I did it, this is what we did. There has to be that understanding, that dynamic, and that respect of what is your role and where do they cross over. There can be crossover, but the most successful dynamics, and this one isn't cited on here, but if you look at, you know, research done between the dynamic of a certified athletic trainer in an institutional setting and a football coaching staff, you know, the most dynamics and the ones that had the best experience were where there was a clear role identity and one person could acknowledge what is the other person the best at, where do they come in on this, and where do I take over. But a concern might be, well, if we limit how much we're hitting during the week, we're going to play soft, right? We're not going to hit as much on Friday night or Saturday night. And in this study and several others, that wasn't really the case. This is some collected data from shared data from a user last year using our Insight training tool system. But the study that I've referenced here showed that there was no significant change in the number of impacts or the exposure on a game day. And that the number of impacts to the top of the head actually went down. So I'm going to ask you guys here, I've got a helmet here, I'm going to show you an example. Anybody ever see a coach teach a drill that you thought was a good one? Where he coached the player to hit like this? Probably not, right? Does anybody ever see, remember that time when you had that kid that kept coming to your training room, whether it was a head injury, neck injury, shoulder, back, something, and you look at the top of his helmet, and it looks like he's been dragging it like this, right? Are there any drills where we want to teach kids to tackle like that, or to hit like that, blocking and tackling? No. Right, so as we look at the data that we can get, we can break it down into a couple of different buckets. Here we have volume, overall number, right? The overall volume of impacts. The intensity is going to be volume plus impacts at that higher magnitude, that higher how hard, if I'm talking to a coach there. Location is this, where on their head. Right, and with the video clip you saw earlier, it doesn't matter where an impact comes from. And we're talking head impact, not helmet impact. We dive way deeper into that, but we're talking about what reaches the head, not the outside of the helmet. Just like in your car, what reaches the driver, not the bumper. And then the load, which loaded is a metric you're going to start hearing more about. I know I heard catapult reference in one of the sessions earlier. Load is not just a strength training, a sports performance type metric, as we're starting to put it into head impacts. You know, what is the cumulative load? Kind of when you take a combined metric of the volume, the intensity, the location, what's the load on that player in regards to head impact exposure? What we can look at is we've collected data and collected data back since 2004. We have position-specific and level-specific impacts to look at a player versus their own data profile. So again, if I told you as a football coach that your starting middle linebacker this week has more impacts to the top of his head than he had the first 6 weeks of the season, no matter where you're at in the season, there's probably something that we could look at when I'm watching film with them and say, look, certain percentage of the time, this is what's happening. Because if a guy's hitting 100% of the time with his head down, you know, right? He's probably already come to see you. But a coach knows that if it's 100% of the time, that's kind of an outlier. But you get into that 25% range, 30% range, we can't watch every rep. And even when we do, we're watching every rep in a subjective manner. I watch a rep, I say, that was good technique. Jam over here might watch a rep, he goes, I'd fix them on that. We've got different knowledge bases, right? And we can also compare a player to the national norm for these types of metrics. So does he have more impacts at the top of his head than linebackers at the high school level nationally? Is that something I could approach coach with? And would he want to know about it? I would think yes. And I would think in your role as an athletic trainer in a clinical setting, there might be something you could take out of that to help embrace that conversation. Instead of going up to him again saying, I don't like that drill, I think we should change it. So if we look at these locations, here's an example. This running back right here, 53% of the impacts on the top of his head. Now, if we actually know what he was doing that day, and we know when his impacts are occurring and what the activity was, if I could tell you that's during blitz pickup drill, which is him practicing protecting our quarterback when he's taking a hot read and he's getting blitzed, coach will want to know, and you'll want to know. Players with good technique. Heard it a couple times this morning, reinforcing player behavior. It's not always going to be, hey, you're messing this up, you need to improve it. If we get an lineman blocking and tackling who has 9 out of every 10 impacts happening in the front, again, we don't want to increase total impacts, but if they're going to happen, we want them seeing where they're hitting. So how do I teach you? Or what instances might this happen in? Do we recognize these guys? I don't know who they are specifically. But we've all seen some big old linemen, right? These guys about 6, he's 6'7", 6'8", maybe, right? 6'5", 6'5", he's a little shorter. They're all big dudes. You go out to a practice, trot like dinosaurs, run like cheetahs. That's how I like to explain it. They trot around, they're big old guys, but then you see them get out into space and they move so quick. So I'll give you an example of how you might use data from a helmet that you otherwise might not have had. Transitioning from the high school level to the college level. Most states, you can't cut or chop block in open space. Right, so situation here. I said bubble screen a couple of times. You can tell I like to, as an O-lineman, get out in space and throw in some cut blocks, but these guys getting out into space, you gotta teach that technique, because before a guy could cut block in the box, we're talking line of scrimmage, obviously you can't chop block where a guy engages up top and you take his legs out, but now we gotta teach these guys, the biggest guys on the field, and it's at most levels can move pretty well, how do we teach that guy to take a hop pull like this, run 12 yards out here and then dive into something without hitting his head on the ground and hurting himself, right? You'll see a lot of programs as they teach this and as we've evolved and there's better equipment. It used to be they would just run out there and dive at something and roll through. All right, from working with coaches, this is a specific example I'm citing where coaches look at that, and now they've got those positional impacts. Telling them when their O-linemen were getting hit on the back of the head. And you drill that down to what drill was it. It was individual drill where we're teaching hop pulls and cutting on screens. All right, so you might take one of those little 2-inch, 3-inch crash pads that you've got laying around to soften the surface that they're landing on. Or if you take one of those cylindrical tackling dummies, they're probably rolling into and someone's holding up. And this is a very simple thing. Instead of hitting the bottom of that and rolling under and someone holds the top, so it sways out like this and pendulums, the guy holding on lets go so that player can now roll on top of the dummy instead of the ground. Taking down the head impact exposure to the back of that player's head. Now, for a lot of programs, you might just think it's teaching cutting. But if your program who runs those types of plays or you're teaching that technique every week, is there something to be learned from it? So if we look at week to week, the impact trend, we're going to consider those trends, the volume, the intensity, the load, and the location as what we would call training opportunities. Trends that we know about now where something's out of the ordinary. This is some data from a team last season again, field trial user. Taking data, first 2 weeks, you can kind of see how these are elevated. What happened was we were still working on this platform. How do we implement this? They had data collection, but they didn't have access to the platform when we got to this point here, the first 2 weeks. We flipped it on, start using that information. It's now information in coaches' hands. And every instance will be different. And we can dig in on the studies and research. A big factor will be the style of play, the style of coaching. But the levels of contact can be modified by using data and trends that otherwise you would really have no way to get your hands on. So as we look at this entire process, the first part is to have an understanding, have a process and a plan with your coaching staff. Make sure there's a clear understanding of what your role is, what their role is, but more importantly, where they cross over. And how can we use those to better protect the player? As we do that, set ways to identify those opportunities. If you, in your experience, start seeing players from a specific group on a team that are coming to you with the same type of injuries, the same type of treatment, have a conversation with coach about it. Again, if you have data supported, it helps it even more whether you have a smart helmet or not. And then to implement the change. There's a couple ways planning things goes. It's what we plan to do, what actually happened, and how we'll do it again the next time. That's the coaching process. So we implement that, and then we manage the activity moving forward. So really, to summarize everything today, what we're looking to do is take information that was never available before. For a football coach, for a physician, for an athletic trainer, and put it in their hands so they can proactively address what's going on in the sport of football. If I look at you guys as a collective room, and from our standpoint as a company, we value what's out there. But as we design tools, we want to say, what can we give you that actually influences your day-to-day activity? Now, if you know structural components and materials and have feedback, great, bring it. Right? And everybody else in the industry would love to hear it too. But we also want to be able to give tools to better actually manage players, to manage a program, and ultimately lead football to a stronger and more intelligent future.